I'm Rachel Newton.
And I'm Lauren McCall. Welcome to the Heal and Harrow podcast.
The 16th and 17th century Scottish witch trials were one of the darkest periods of Scotland's history. An estimated 2,500 people, mostly women, were executed and many more accused. With Heal and Harrow, we seek to pay a humanising tribute to these women while also exploring historical beliefs in the supernatural and modern-day parallels in our society today.
Our project takes the form of an album and a live show. The music is based on specially commissioned works by celebrated author Mary Kidd. Tales inspired by and in remembrance of real women who were persecuted and tried as witches, and characters from the folkloric tales and mythology enshrined in our oral culture. These stories form part of her brilliant book, We Are All Witches.
In this podcast, we discuss the women who inspired the work, Mary's writing process, and how we went about creating our musical response. We'll also hear excerpts from the stories themselves, read by 10 brilliant women from across Scotland.
Do click the subscribe button to make sure you catch each episode as soon as it's released. And if you would like to rate and review, that would be much appreciated as it really helps us reach more ears. You can find links to purchase our album, Mary's book, and download the story readings in full at healandharrow.com.
This week's episode is Dadim, read by musician, composer, performer and producer Inga Thompson. Here's Mary to tell us more about Dadim.
Catherine is a fictional witch, completely fictional. But she came out of a kind of a, I think it's an error in the Survey of Scottish Witchcraft data, because she's listed as being in Fula in Shetland. And we decided that we would look at this witch in Fula. So it looks like quite an outlier when you look at the map of witch persecutions. And off I went faithfully, as effectively as I could, given that it was locked down and, you know, libraries and other facilities were closed, to track down the court book of Shetland that had the lists of all the legal cases to find out if I could find out any more about this Catherine Thomas Dochter in Fula who'd been tried for witchcraft. And when the court book, when I got my mitts on it, it's not an easy read because, of course, the language is very unfamiliar. I discovered that actually Catherine Thomas Dochter in Fula was not tried for witchcraft. There was a girl called Catherine Thomas Dochter in Fula who appears in the court book, but what she's actually accused of, I think, is stealing diverse items of linen from her mistress. So she must be a serving girl. And the Catherine Thomas Dochter who was accused of witchcraft was in North Yale. And I thought, what will I do? And I thought it would be really interesting just to take a woman who didn't exist, but stick with that idea of Fula's, well, relatively speaking, remote part of the Shetland Islands. And so felt I had free rein then to explore the fact that Shetland and Orkney too, in that era, you know, they'd passed from Norse ownership into Scottish ownership, and the culture and language were kind of in flux. Actually, even some of the things we think people would do that we would recognise it. For example, knitting as we know it wasn't being done then. There was a kind of Norse knitting that we think they would have done, but the idea of some of the iconic things that we associate with places had not yet come into being. So I imagined a story about a girl who is a young girl and has been accused of witchcraft really maliciously. And she's housed, because she can't be taken away from Fula to be tried, she's housed with a kind of, by their own lights, important local family, an important man and his wife. And really the story is about the relationship between the wife and the witch. And there's another woman, there's a mother, the old wife. She has a very different attitude to Catherine, the witch. So in some ways, I think probably I was almost quite purposely wanting to look at some perhaps small community dynamics and island dynamics. And it was lovely to have a kind of fictional, I felt like I was freed from having to represent anyone's story accurately and just kind of actually to write a fiction.
Thank you.
There is no court in this island of 200 souls, no jail and no stronghouse. The lawman comes now and then to hear the petty crimes. The serving lass who stands accused of stealing a few small items of linen from her mistress, or the fisherman who, having lost his boat, has taken advantage of a moonless night to relieve his neighbour of a dozen saith drying out by in his skew. These matters are settled with little pain. The accused finds witnesses to speak for them. Fines are paid. And then there's only the shame to bear for the guilty party, and even that fades in time. Some care little enough in the first place, of course, sunk deep as they are in drink, or so often in rough company that their crimes seem rather less a cross to bear than a fine boast to make when they are in their cups. The greater crimes are heard in Scalloa, the murders, the grievous violences visited upon a body, and the gravest of thefts. Scalloa is a grand place in mainland, bustling with trade and travel, and crowned with a tall castle Black Petey built for himself 3 years back with labour stolen from every parish in the islands. There is lodging there for the accused, although none would willingly put themselves in that place. No one in Fula has ever put their mind to what might happen if a person were to be accused of a crime of magnitude when there was no lawman due. At a time of bad weather, or when the men were busy with the harvest. Why would they? No one has anything of great value to be stolen. And no murder has been committed here in living memory, nor for many generations past. A churchman might have known what to do in such circumstances. But there is no churchman here in this stifling summer of 1603. The last one was carried off by a sweating sickness, and no one has yet come to take his place. Perhaps there is no one to arrange it. The woman, Gorvald Federstatter, who owned Fula as part of the lands of Vela, died last year. The island was leased to Robert Sheens for the last 30 years of her life, but King Christian, far off in Copenhagen, is now the owner of it all. And heaven knows he must have bigger things to worry about. And so, when Catherine Thomas Doctor is accused of witchcraft, in a month of unseasonable thunderstorms and heavy seas, no one quite knows what to do. When Ingrid first hears of the thing from William, he is drunk and swollen with self-importance. These have been difficult days, with so much work stopped by the weather. There can be no fishing and precious little gleaning of birds from the cliffs, and so the men have nothing to do but watch as the bare crop is washed from the fields. Between the lightning and the lashing rains, it is hot and sticky, although Johnsmas is some weeks past. Still, there is almost no darkness at night, so the men lie restless in their beds with want of labour, to tire them out, and drift to drink to pass the weary hours. Later, Ingrid will see that this is the perfect breeding ground for thoughts of evil. As fungus grows on the rye, so suspicion grows in the minds of men. Right now, though, she is busy with the baby William, and little Margaret has her driven almost to distraction, apparently determined to fall Hidicraw into the fire any time Ingrid's back is turned. The unseemly conduct of a lass that she barely knows from the far side of the island is of little interest to her, particularly if it means listening to William, puffed up with righteousness, as though he has not done his fair share of drinking or footering with servant girls. William has to tell her twice that the girl is to stay with them here before she hears him. "Edessus?" she repeats, stupid with surprise. "What, why?" She wishes she'd listened properly in the first place then, for now she must drop the kishy of pits that she's carried in and listen to a repeat of William's censorious account of lewd behaviour before he explains that the choice of their home to house the witch is an honour of sorts. It shows the high regard in which he is held in the island, he says, and the fine situation of their home here compared to the lowly state of so many others. "And the bairns?" Ingrid asks. She has no real notion of witchcraft, and so far William's account has focused on one woman's low morals. "Thinks do that the witch will pit herself about to harm them?" William has clearly not thought of this. "Na, na," he says. "Faith, it'll just be four nichts or five till they tack her to Scalloa." He looks uncertain for a moment, but then shakes his head, determined. "E week," he says. na Lochmere.
But what you were quite set on in terms of accuracy was to write it in dialect.
Yes, everybody, when they speak, uses Shetland dialect. And I was determined to do that. And I think because you guys had, I think you'd hit on the idea of the Fula Witch yourselves and had suggested it. We talked about that, showing the culture and language is such a big part of the culture. And then, I mean, I've never regretted anything so much in my life. It's really hard to write in a dialect of, you know, that you don't speak and it is unfamiliar. For all, there's a huge amount of writing actually in Shetlandic. You know, they've got a brilliant wee kind of small press culture where folk use the language. I love even seeing like pals from Shetland when they're typing on Facebook to each other that they use all the Shetland words. And I love that. We were lucky in the sense that you guys very kindly put me in touch with Maurice Henderson, who is just an authority in all things Shetland, and I had an amazing afternoon. He read the story and he put me right in a few D's and do's that were in the wrong place. He told me so much actually about kind of later traditions of witchcraft, a woman called Maggie Grew, who was a Shetland witch, and it was fascinating. And actually after my conversation with Maurice, I made some wee changes to the story to put in some of the kind of local colour that he gave me in our chat, and he was very, very generous with his time.
I think it was nice to involve him because that is his dialect, as you say, but I've always known Maurice to be a great storyteller, and that just fitted so well to not just put you in touch with somebody who was perhaps an academic or a historian, but somebody who lives and breathes that language and that culture.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that felt important.
I think there was something interesting too when Maurice and I were talking about how it can be difficult to imagine a place in the past. We kind of are inclined to sort of make assumptions about, you know, populations being smaller because, you know, the overall population of Scotland was much smaller. But sometimes you find actually that at different points in history, populations, for example, of islands were actually bigger because of, you know, differences in land ownership, differences in crop cultivation and what, you know, that obviously the Highlands is the very obvious model where an awful lot of small farming was cleared away to make space for the great shooting estates. And so it's hard to know what would Highland landscape have looked like because the ecology isn't the same as it would have been then. And we talked a lot because in the story, Catherine Thomasdochter and Ingrid, who's the wife, don't know each other. Maurice was saying, you know, would it be possible to have lived in Fula then and not have known someone from the other side of the island? I'd kind of imagined Ingrid as having maybe come to Fula as a wife, not necessarily being from there. And so perhaps, you know, having been busy basically having babies, so not necessarily have been paying attention to other people. I didn't necessarily mean literally she'd never laid eyes on her, but, you know, she'd never registered her. You know, we reflected a lot on that. You feel you know a place very well, but it's very difficult to imagine what it looked like.
The old wife keeps to the byre the next day, and Ingrid fidgets and fusses until at last they arrive. They have brought the girl on foot, although it is many miles and the ground is so wet it is hard to tell a field from a burn in spate. It is another sullen day, with thunder brewing under leaden skies. The rain has not come, but the taste of it is on the air. Ingrid stands in the door and shades her eyes to see them as they appear over the brow of the hill. One small green figure and two tall grey ones. They toil across the Uthil land and up the steep hill to the house. And at last Ingrid gets a look at the witch. There is nothing very evil about her countenance, quite the opposite in fact. Just a small, slight girl with blue eyes and butter yellow hair under a neat white kerchief. Although her feet and her skirts are liberally plastered with mud, she is otherwise trimly turned out, and she stands there between the two stern old men like a sunbeam between two crows. For all her golden glow, there is a coolness about the girl. In the heat of this sticky day, Ingrid shifts her shoulders inside her own sweaty bodice, suddenly conscious of the dried milk stains on the wool, She wishes she'd taken the chance to wash. Margaret hides in her skirts, uncharacteristically shy. "Men, come a-wawin'," says William. Ingrid watches as they stoop one by one under the low door. The girl stops, uncertain, and looks to Ingrid, but one of the men reaches back out and pulls her inside. William and the men sit in the chairs by the fire. The girl stands behind them. "Will they take a dram?" asks William, "or a bite of brownie?" Both are accepted and Ingrid busies herself fetching food and cups, hampered by Margaret, who still clings to her like a limpet. Then she stands with the girl, watching the men eat and drink. Baby William begins to grizzle, and Ingrid takes a seat at the back of the room to feed him. The girl watches under lowered lids, but she remains where she is. When they have taken their fill, the men tell William they will return as soon as the weather breaks. They shake hands solemnly and take their leave, keen to be on their way before the worst of the rain. William watches them go, and then it is clear he has no idea what to do next. He looks at the girl and at his wife, and then ridiculously bolts out of the door like a panicked colt. Ingrid can't help herself, she rolls her eyes. The girl doesn't laugh though, and Ingrid realises she must be worn out. "Set thee doon," she says, "till the bairn has had his sook." The girl hesitates and then takes a seat on the stool by the wall. Margaret ventures closer. "Good day," Catherine says to the child. "Is do William?" Margaret laughs. "Nah, Margaret," she says. "Catherine," Catherine tells her. "William's my brother," says Margaret, gesturing to the baby in Ingrid's arms. "Ah," says Catherine, nodding. "Do's his peery sister then." Margaret laughs at this nonsense. She seems set to go to Catherine, but just then the door darkens and the old wife comes in. Margaret runs back to her mother, and Catherine gets to her feet. "Is yonder witch?" the old wife says. Ingrid bites her tongue not to say, "Nah, that's the Queen of Denmark here to see thee, mither." Instead, she gives a curt nod. The baby is asleep now, his mouth slack. She lays him on her knee and laces up her bodice. "Catherine," she says, "Catherine Thomas, doctor." The old wife harumphs and takes a seat by the fire. Ingrid gestures to Catherine to sit. "The maid is gane hame," the old wife announces, "to keep her frae harm." There is no more conversation that afternoon.
I think when we stumbled upon this case, or this confused case as it is, as you say, it was on the Survey of Scottish Witchcraft, which, if anyone hasn't come across, that is an amazing resource and a very visual resource. So when you're dealing with a lot of research and looking into records, it can be, and especially if you're not a historian, very wordy, and you're often dealing with Old English, Old Scots, and language which is really difficult to get your head around. But this survey and this database online, which anyone can access, is an amazing map where you can put in your locality, your parish, your wider area, and it will come up with the cases in that area. And I suppose the Fuller case just, yeah, it sprung out straight off the map as being isolated in that way, but also you had already expressed that so many of these stories were so similar in the way that what happened to these women were so similar and perhaps their experience. But we thought, well, there's probably a slightly different story to be told there, even if it is that it's just through another dialect. Yeah, it just kind of threw up quite a lot of discussions around that and discussions about how all of these executions and the loss of all these women also equaled a massive loss of knowledge and language and the things that come with that as a community dwindles. Yeah, it feels like that case represents quite a lot of different things.
I was told, and I it's terrible, I can't remember now, it was just in a conversation, and I have a feeling it was the writer James Robertson, but I could be wrong. So apologies, James, if you hear this and it wasn't you. But I was told that our major source of women's words, and so women's words in the Scots language from the early modern period, is the witch trials. you're kind of taken aback when you think about that. So actually, there is a huge, rich linguistic database there, in a sense, because you can hear how people speak because they're giving testimony or confessions. And you can really hear these voices coming to you. And, you know, for all what they're discussing is very alien, there is sort of such richness, and it's absolutely fascinating, but also shocking, you know, because again, it does tell us that we weren't preserving women's words for all sorts of other reasons.
Late in the afternoon, Ingrid breaks. "Does do spin?" she asks the girl. Catherine jumps and Ingrid realises that she was in a dwam. "Aye," she says. Ingrid hands her the spindle and the distaff laden with fleece. The time passes more easily then, for there's some company in working together. Catherine shows no great talent with the spindle, and the wool she spins is rough, but it's strong and serviceable enough. When the old wife comes in and sees the two women sitting together, she shakes her head. "My mercy," she says under her breath. But she makes no further fuss, and indeed takes the baby so she may change his hippin. Catherine helps lay the dinner out that night before she sits to eat on her own. William and the old wife glower, but they say nothing and eat enough of it to suggest that they have little fear of poison. Indeed, Ingrid thinks William's eye lingers a little too long on Catherine a time or two when he thinks no one is looking. The next day, Catherine brings in peats and water, sweeps the hearth, grinds the meal. She sings under her breath as she goes about her work, and Margaret is her shadow until Ingrid removes the child and takes her into the byre. There, Margaret cries such bitter tears that the old wife gives in. "Let her out," she says, afore she spoils the cheese with her greeting. Released, Margaret runs back to the house. When the cheese work is done, Ingrid finds her there with Catherine. They are seated on the floor making a catch cradle with a length of wool. Ingrid puts William on the floor so she may go about her work. It's the first time she can remember being unencumbered by Margaret since the child was born. She scarcely knows what to do with the piece, for Catherine has already baked bannocks and oat cakes and set a stew to hotter. Dried fish is soaking in milk, and there's a large vessel with a lid on by the fire. Catherine opens up and smells malt. "Ale," Catherine says, "the start of it." "Did your mither learn to yun?" "Aye," said Catherine, "she did last winter. My father soon after." Ingrid feels her heart soften towards the girl. She is too young to be alone in the world.
I might not be correct in this, and I don't know how one would go about being correct in this, but in a sense I chose to write about a world in which they weren't quite so well versed in the witchcraft stuff. They're not in one of these hotbed areas where people would have been touched by a witch trial somehow, because so many happened in some of these communities. So they're far less aware of what it means. Catherine's quite naive. She kind of thinks, well, I'll go to the court and I'll tell them what happened and then they'll send me home. And Ingrid is a bit more cynical, a bit older, a bit kind of... She also sees that these men are taking Catherine and they know some of Catherine's backstory and they don't have sympathy for her. And she starts to see how this is a sort of abuse. It's not put in those terms, but a sort of abuse of power.
And the way that the rest of the adults in the family, her husband and her mother-in-law, kind of treat Catherine, you know, in this very suspicious, but also kind of like she's, you know, she's not a human. She's a witch. She'll sleep on the floor and they won't be in the same room as her.
But they're enjoying it as well. Yeah. The mother-in-law's really enjoying it.
Yeah. Because, you know, the mother-in-law's now the centre of kind of attention and the neighbours are coming to have a good look at the witch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's also, and I did that on purpose because some of them have to have enjoyed it. Maybe there's a streak in all of us or just in some people particularly of loving drama. And some people seem to attract drama, but some folks seem to kind of come alive when there's a bit of nasty gossip just spread around. It plays with the idea of different strokes for different folks. This isn't a community where everyone thinks in the same way. Some of them are kind, some of them are not, just as all communities are. They're obviously very dependent on each other for survival. If they don't cooperate to a degree, they won't survive. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there aren't divergent ways of thinking amongst them. And I think that's something that's quite important. We can simplify people in the past too much, I think, and kind of look at them as almost childlike.
Why does Dutak the prophet for the milk? The question is out of Ingrid's mouth before she knows it. Catherine looks at her as though she is soft in the head. "Dinna ask me," she says. Ingrid feels her face colour. "They think you did it," she says, "and other things." "Nah, they never talked that," Catherine says. "They ten the chance of it to say I was a witch. They set themselves against me for other reasons." Ingrid lifts an eyebrow and Catherine sighs. "There's a neighbour at him," she says at last. "He's had his ee on my feyther's farm since I was a pretty lass, and then my feyther died, and he came snuffling around me. I said I wouldna hae him, but he... There was some cuddering afore I slip at him, and I..." She makes a vague gesture over her belly with a hand. Ingrid put a hand to her neck. "Do you had a burn?" she says. "What is it?" "It came a while before its time," Catherine says. "His mither said I kent what to do to slip it, but it just came a while. And after that, they never heard the lick of what they fun to say about me. And then they said they would tak me a while." Ingrid sits down, her head spinning. The warp threads of this tale are the same as those in the censorious account that William gave her, but now she can see how the weft has been twisted. "Lass," she says, "thou must tell them he forced thee. Thou was all alane." "I telt them at all," Catherine says. "They say I must tell them in court in Scalloa, then I'll get hame again." Ingrid feels a cold sweat break out on her back. The two scarecrows that brought the girl here knew what happened to her. William knew, and they have done nothing to help her. Worse, they have made the lies real, for Ingrid knows what will happen in Scalloa. They will speak high, confusing the girl and twisting her tail to condemn her. When they find her guilty, and they will hang her by a rope of lies, and they will burn her body or lay it in unhallowed ground.
Some of the words that we chose to use for the track, I suppose one of the word in particular being grief, just found that very human word to use in that sense of families and communities grieving for a person, something we haven't touched upon and isn't spoken about in that way. But it felt important for us to use that line in the song to acknowledge that not only were these people, but that their demise would have touched so many lives. that line in the song is particularly poignant.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's such a short couple of lines that we've used for that little song element. But what was important in the process of the sort of lyrics section of the album was that it could be, I suppose, in the same sense that we have these parallels that we draw to modern day and we want to try and relate to these stories and what happened. It felt kind of important. If you were listening to this track, you could almost relate it to yourself, or it could be about something quite modern. Like, it's not being descriptive of this happened in this year, and it's a little bit more obscure. And I suppose in a way, the sense of grief is something that happens to us all, and it's universal, and any time of history, there must have been an element there.
I think that's a place where we can do the past down and we can consider ourselves so greatly superior. There used to be an understanding, for example, that, you know, childhood didn't really come into being as a kind of concept until very late because, you know, so many children died in infancy. And sometimes you read these amazing statements about how, you know, so people weren't particularly attached to their children until they saw if they were going to survive. And I was thinking, lions are attached to their young. No species is going to survive on the basis that, you know, I'm really fussed if that one dies or doesn't. We other them too much. I must admit, for me, that idea of the destruction of the bodies is about stopping people grieving. You know, it's taking away, as well as taking away, you know, the idea of the witch coming back like some kind of voodoo nonsense in a B-movie. It's also about taking away the right to kind of memorialise someone. And, you know, you see cases like, there's a woman, Jonet Wisher, in Aberdeen, and the family are also accused, but only Jonet dies. And, you know, and then they're banished from Aberdeen. And part of you thinks, well, you wouldn't really want to hang around after they burned your mother. But the other part you think, so where did they go? Did they just become itinerants? Did they lose everything? Did they lose their community? And I think sometimes it did really destabilise communities. It's interesting thinking about the ones who were accused and went and survived it, and how do you get on with your neighbours after they've tried to have you burned as a witch? That maybe brings me on to what I was thinking when I wrote the story, which is in some ways different too. I was thinking about an island situation in which I heard a crime of sexual violence described sort of as the fault of the victim. And I was thinking about sometimes, you know, in some small places you can get some attitudes like that that are worthy of a bit of challenge, shall we say. And I think I was thinking about an idea of something very specific to it, but I didn't ever mean to make it literally about that. So I'm glad if it doesn't come across, and what comes across is the sort of sadness of poor Catherine's demise. We haven't said the dim does mean it's the dim, and it's the simmer dim. It's the point in the summer when in the north it doesn't get dark. And so they're sort of stuck in this never-ending day as this all these really dark things happen, but there's no escape from the daylight. And that, I don't know where it came from, but I love playing with that idea that, you know, what they're desperate for is a dark night to kind of, to just let go and grieve.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Heal and Harrow podcast, produced by us, Heal and Harrow, and recorded and edited by Grant Anderson. All the music you heard is from our self-titled album, with thanks to Mary Kidd and Inga Thompson.
You can buy our album, a copy of Mary's book We Are All Witches, and hear the stories in full by visiting healandharrow.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Bye for now.